10 years of OK Radio, repulsive to the talk radio community. Billie Eilish fashions, courtesy of Idaho. Tonight, lesbians, strippers, and other ratings grabbers. I'm your announcer, James Copeland.
Coming up tonight, Alice is dead. Plus, new news about lesbianism. First, Dr. Dave, Thanksgiving weather.
More news, more news. Day and night around the clock, it's your news. You get it all when you set your dial to Sterling every damn night. Sterling every damn night. Sterling every damn night.
Second, you're going to learn that Alice is dead. Plus, I found exclusive archival audio of President Trump clearing up two things. No, he didn't run for president to sell a book. And two, no, he wouldn't do business with Moscow. It's fascinating. Where are all the hardcore talk show hosts with that information? That's in just seconds. But far more important, Cara Delevingne, a model, British model, who's a notorious lesbian. Cara Delevingne. Search it. Ask your grandchildren. She secretly lived with Taylor Swift for a bit. Now she's opening up about what it's really like sharing a home with one of the world's biggest pop stars and her longtime dear friend. Taylor has so many longtime dear friends. I was going through a really horrible breakup, and she let me live with her, Delevingne told somebody. We're very different people. She's very homely. The British use the word differently. She meant she's a homebody, not ugly. She's very homely because she looked after me so well. But we got into some trouble. Is that what they're calling it now? Not trouble, but I definitely took her for a bit of a wild ride. Don't. Just don't. Just to get her to blush would be great. So Cara's goal is to get her girlfriend, Taylor, to blush. The British actress added that she could roast Swift because of the experience. Swift could dish it back, though. Delevingne revealed, citing a speech Swift gave at a wedding, it was a roast. She's one of the funniest, most clever people. Anyone could roast her easily, but at the same time, she could tuck everyone up so hard. Delevingne is the second star this week to open up about what Swift is like in her private life. Blackpink's Rosé also spoke about, what the hell is that? What's Blackpink's Rosé? Is that the name? Is that the stage name of some entertainer? Blackpink Rosé? What should I be? Hardcore Diet Coke? Should that be? I need to be Hard Diet Coke the God. There you go. Hard Diet Coke, the God. That's what I will be from now on. Let's get a jingle on that. Delevingne is the second star this week to open up about what Swift is like in a private life. Blackpink's Rosé also spoke about... How does a Rosé speak? Also spoke about how much Swift helped her in her music career in an interview. The K-pop singer had seen her last September at Electric Lady Studios. Quote, I told her I'm such a big fan and I just had some questions, Rosé said, noting she'd been working on solo music at the time. As soon as she met me, she's like, Spill, let me help you out. She gave me her experiences and was so ready to help me. She gave me her number and was like, let me know if you have any questions. This woman whose last name is Rosé, Hard Pink Rosé, and Cara Delevingne, a notorious lesbian, lived with Taylor Swift for months and gave her an exciting time. Well, what the hell else do you think that is? Cara Delevingne has tons of money. She's not some struggling model. She came from a rich, wealthy family. She is surrounded by trusts, estate plans, thick folders explaining where her wealth lives. She doesn't need to live with Taylor Swift. She could stay at a premium hotel a block from Taylor in Tribeca. There are many. In fact, the Tribeca Grand is a fantastic hotel within walking distance of Taylor Swift's townhouse. I don't get it. Why doesn't Taylor just say it. You know, and then she's got this staged relationship. I'm very uncomfortable with this Kelsey relationship she's got. I don't know which Kelsey it is. Is it Travis? Which one does she have? Did I mention I'm dying? Pay no attention to that. She's with a Kelsey, right? And every time they're together, if you watch her when she doesn't think she's being watched, she looks a little uncomfortable. And the public displays look a little forced. It's hard for me to believe that that's a real relationship because, you know, Mr. Kelsey, like Ms. Swift, can have anybody they want. They could have anybody they want. And to me, in my wisdom, it doesn't look like a good relationship. It doesn't look like a real relationship. That would be my key concern. But about Donald. Now, there are all these geniuses who said, oh, he only ran the first time to sell books. Really, that's all he planned to do. Well, to go through what he went through the first time, just to get on the ballot, is an amazing achievement for a human being. But I know for a fact that it's not true, that he always wanted to be president. I want you to listen to this clip from a 1988 interview with the famous Terry Wogan in England. Listen to this clip. Tight as a drum. I gotta tell you, it's so exciting for me to do this. Do you have them there, my friend? Yeah, just play it.
Well, I have been asked this question for many times.
Go on.
It is still speculation, but you never know with Don. You know, he goes in 10 years, whatever he built in 10 years is just so phenomenal that there are eventually going to be different fields which he's going to go into. And I never say never, and it might be politics one day.
You made a political statement recently. You publicized your political views, didn't you?
Well, I hate to see what's happening to the United States. It's the great country, and I can't say the greatest country because I'll be in big trouble.
Sounds familiar. There he is with Terry Wogan in London in 1988. And his first wife, his real wife, is saying, hey, he could be in politics. Pay attention. He's like, yeah, maybe. But then all the clowns that imagine he had Russian collusion, listen to what he says about doing business in Russia.
You're going to build a hotel in Moscow, tell me.
No, it's really very unlikely. They wanted us to, and we went over to Moscow, and we looked. But the cultures are so different. The whole concept of doing things over there is so different that I've really decided that I probably won't do.
He probably won't do business with Moscow. 1988. To me, there it is. No Russian anything. And he really wanted to be president. He wasn't selling books. Don't be an a-hole and say, oh, he was selling books. Stupid. All right, it's 15 past the hour. 15 past the hour with Walter M. Sterling. This is Sterling every damn Sunday.
Dan and Becky, Gaffney, the kids.
150-year-old house.
Dan and Becky, Bicker, and Sterling every damn night.
I'm Dan Gaffney.
And I'm Becky Gaffney.
We're here to tell you about life with our 8 kids in our old house. I feel like I've never been so prepared for Thanksgiving because weeks ago I saw at the discount grocery store organic crunchy onions.
Which is kind of funny because we're never really prepared for Thanksgiving. Like last minute we're deciding whether we're doing subs, pasta, or finding a turkey somewhere.
So I bought these, and of course in our house with all the kids I have to hide it so that they don't get eaten. But now, you can't just buy Campbell's soup to use the cream of mushroom soup to put in with these crunchy onions because that negates the whole organic vibe I'm going for.
Right.
So I had to special order organic condensed mushroom soup on Amazon.
Because you can't have like the corn syrup and yellow dye coming into your Thanksgiving dinner. Everything's got to be clean. And if you're going to go for the casserole, it's got to be a clean casserole.
So that has arrived, also stashed in this special green bean casserole area of the kitchen.
The green bean casserole area?
Yes, which I've also added the no salt green beans, if you've noticed.
Right, but I really think we need to use the salted green beans. I don't think that you can do an organic green bean casserole and make it taste anything like the nasty, funky Campbell's green bean casserole unless you have all the sodium. Sodium is something I welcome at Thanksgiving. Like when I have turkey, which, by the way,
that's why we have a salt shaker.
It's my favorite food. I love it super salty, kind of like me. All right, so basically the recipe. There is no recipe when you're dealing with the green bean casserole.
You dump the beans in, some of the onions, the soup, bake it, throw onions on the top, bake it a little more, you're done.
Right, when it's crunchy at the end. Basically, the key is everything in there gets warm because nothing really needs to be cooked. You just warm it up, and then at the end, you dump the crunchy onions on so it's crunchy. Okay. Now, that is my number one favorite Thanksgiving food. My number two favorite Thanksgiving food is the nasty, disgusting, gelatinous cranberry sauce.
I also tried to order that organic, and I haven't had any luck.
Right. This is a problem. My whole family has always made, like, this really amazing, wonderful, oh, it's like a cranberry chutney. It's so lovely and delicious and all natural. It's not good. I need the disgusting piece of blobby Jell-O that comes out in the shape of a can.
Right. So that's a little peek into our Thanksgiving. We wish you and everyone on the Walter Sterling Show a happy Thanksgiving.
If you're looking for a turkey, you can find my husband on Facebook at
Dan Gaffney Show. And if you're looking for extra salt, find my wife on Instagram
as Just Being Mom.
Dan and Becky, Sterling every damn night.
Sterling on Sunday. Coming up.
Have a plan for Black Friday. The people of Walmart. Later. Sterling every damn night.
I'm smutty book author Thea Landon, and I have a late night story for Midnight Misfits on Sterling every damn night.
Dancers, know your rights. Later. Strippers on the loose. Sterling every damn night.
Sterling on Sunday, inspired by Judge Judy.
What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you?
Joan Pankow is a world-famous astrologer and psychic. And when Pluto went into the house of Aquarius, I said, I need to talk to Joan, and I need Joan Pankow to tell me what the heck that means.
Hello?
Yes, you hear me?
I can hear you. Are we on yet?
We're on the air, yes.
Okay, so what do you want to know about Pluto?
I want to know what it means that Pluto moved to the house of Aquarius Joan Pankow.
Okay, so the planet Pluto is the furthest out planet in our solar system, and it moves very slowly, and its effects are very deep and long-lasting. There's a joke among astrologers that the slowest planet wins. So when Pluto changes sign, it's a really big deal in the astrology world, because it only happens approximately every 20 years, okay? And this happened last week. So we're starting a new 20-year Plutonian cycle of Pluto in Aquarius. And to get a little perspective on how this is going to play out over the next 20 years, the last 2 years, when Pluto was in the last 2 degrees of Capricorn, we had what is called in the USA a Pluto return. And what that means is, at the time this country was born in 1776 and the chart was formed for the USA, Pluto was in the exact position 28, 29 degrees Capricorn it was in for the last 2 years. And what that means, it's called a recurrence in astrology, is that we just kicked off another, shall we say, 240 years of a rebirth and a revolution in America.
So we're looking at a rebirth and a revolution in America because Pluto is in the house of Aquarius. What else can we look forward to?
So if you think about the last time Pluto was in this position, we had a country that was completely split in two between people that supported King George and people that wanted freedom and insurrection. And over the next 20 years, there was a Revolutionary War. A lot of people died, a lot of people suffered, but we ended up with a new country based on freedom and democracy. So where we're at now in the next 20 years is the next level of what happened the last time Pluto was in this position. So it's a very exciting time to be alive, Walter, because this is the next level of what America and independence and democracy is going to look like, and it's going to be playing out over the next 20 years. It's just kicking off now. Okay? It's just starting now.
Is there any, Joan Panko, astrologer and psychic, is there anything we should be cautious about as individuals?
So, on a national level, the dark side of Pluto, especially in Aquarius, is any kind of political or religious fanaticism. Okay, that's the dark side. But the light side, the positive side of Pluto in Aquarius, is freedom for all. Aquarius is the sign of altruism, humanitarianism, alleviating suffering for people that need help. And Aquarius also rules computers, IT, AI, all that high-tech stuff is going to be, we have to watch out that it serves us and it doesn't control us. And we're just getting glimmers of all of this now, because this is going to be a 20-year evolution of Pluto and Aquarius that just started last week. Okay?
Joan Panko is an astrologer, yeah, and a psychic. Joan Panko, how do we get in touch with you for more information?
So you can just go to my website, joanpanko.com, P-A-N-C-O-E, or call me at 212-982-6820.
Radio being the joy that it is, you'll need to repeat the phone number three times.
212-982-6820. That's enough. Can I say something about people being affected by Pluto and Aquarius on a personal level?
Yes, please.
Okay. So in the last 2 years, anyone whose sun sign was at the last 2 degrees of Capricorn, that means they were born, anyone born about January 19th or 20th, has experienced a very challenging, rough 2 years of death and rebirth. Because Pluto on the sun, you experience, you feel like you're dying, and then you get reborn, like a new identity. And now people with Pluto at zero Aquarius, which means they were born, anyone born with their sun at January 21st or 22nd, are going to be undergoing a 2-year metamorphosis in which parts of them will be dying and falling away, and new parts of them will be reborn, just like in this country.
Oh, my gosh. Joan Panko, it sounds exhausting. I am so grateful that you're my friend and you're on the show. Thank you very, very much. Joan Panko, psychic, an astrologer. She's got a great website, P-A-N-C-O-E, joanpanko.com. Find out what's in your stars. Get in touch with her. All right, good evening. I'm Walter M. Sterling. Look at this. It's a big network radio show. Are you scared of the power of this show? I'm terrified. Sterling every damn night.
Sterling on Sunday. Inspired by the movie Voice Guy.
They called her Aurora. Yes, they named her after the dawn, for she filled their lives with sunshine.
More news, day and night, around the clock, it's your news. You get it all when you set your dial to Sterling every damn night. Sterling every damn night.
Matthias, Boom Boom Hollywood, welcome. What's the big gossip? What's the news? What's the box office from this weekend?
My gosh, Wicked has completely taken over the box office, Walter, at $114 million in just a few days since it opened, and they're very happy in Hollywood. I don't get it, because I thought Wicked wasn't that great, and I know I'll probably be crucified for this, but however, the fact is I found it long to start and a little bit ponderous and just too much of a good thing. Great singing, fine performances, great production design. It's just too much. And after almost 3 hours, it's only the first half of the show. We don't even get the second half till next year. But audiences disagreed with me in droves. And so good for the movie business.
How long will the second half be?
Oh, I can't tell you. I don't know in advance, but I'm sure they're going to try to make them about an equal amount of time since the audience is eating this up right now. So they probably see a future cash cow. I know the bean counters are thrilled right now, at least this weekend.
Does this make Ariana Grande a movie star?
I think she'll have more work. She was very good with her comedy in this because she plays Glinda, who is, of course, somewhat of an airhead, and not saying that Miss Grande is an airhead, but she plays one quite well, and, you know, you have to be good at what you're doing to be believable, and she managed to pull that off, and her singing was great. So, kudos to her.
Ariana
and Mr. Rebo, too, who certainly can sing.
Ariana Grande is a great singer, and all of her roles on Nickelodeon were comedic. She was the the laugh character. She was the character that got laughs.
And she certainly does here as well in Wicked, too. So
I wonder what
perhaps
she got
your
paid
daughters love it.
Wonder what she got
I
paid
don't
for
know
this.
What she got paid. Yeah. I don't know. I'll have to do some investigation there.
Yeah. What would you guess? Like $20 million probably, plus?
Yes, of course, in some sort of a percentage. And, of course, billing. Those are all important things that the actors' agents squabble over and their lawyers.
One of the things I've explained is something you just said. I can't tell you how many times I've been in meetings where people go, well, you know, I should come first. Or this is, I go, do you understand right now in Hollywood, there are teams of lawyers fighting over nothing but where they get their clients get placed in the credit roll. That's a big industry. Big industry where my client gets placed in the credit roll. And by the way, an interesting thing that her agent did. When she was on Sam and Cat and when she was on Victorious on Nickelodeon, she never sang a solo. And that could not have been an accident. That could not have been an accident. They didn't want that future to get mixed up with cartoonish child shows.
Right. Yep. More carefully controlled for maximum profit.
And Mateus Boom Boom Hollywood, is there another movie you'd like to discuss?
I would like to discuss. I was just going to add one additional thought to that. Not only are these agents fighting for where they are in the credits, but the exhibitors are actually sent out, and certainly have been since the beginning of the movies, an actual billing order in which these people's names would appear on the marquee. So-and-so's name has to be 30% bigger than so-and-so's name, and the name is above the title. They're a star. If they're under the title, they're a supporting player. But they actually list the percentages when they send it to the exhibitors, so they would put up their marquees correctly. Today's movie marquees are either electronic or just sloppy. They look like laundry lists. The lure of the beautiful marquee of the past is just a thing of old Hollywood now, but they still argue about this stuff.
Absolutely. All right, Mateus, what else you got?
We've got Gladiator 2 from Ridley Scott, following 24 years later from the first Gladiator. It is somewhat of a continuation. We've got two actors that were in the first cast that come back, and Connie Nielsen is one, and there's a great English actor whose name just went, Derek Jacobi, who is repeating his role as a Roman senator. But this time around, it's a story of Lucius, who's played by Paul Mescal, who vows to avenge the death of his wife, murdered in a Roman attack led by Marcus Acacius, played by Pedro Pascal. Now, Lucius is thrown to the arena for the amusement of the emperors, and his rage embodies him to rise up in the ranks under the tutelage of a gladiator maker, Macrinus, played by Denzel Washington, who's really deliciously good in this. Lucius plans revenge, but along the way, the plot thickens because Lucius has a secret to the past, And nefarious plans are afoot to take Rome from its twin emperors, who are complete nincompoops. Anyway, having said that, the movie's mostly ridiculous, Walter. Far inferior to the first movie. It has horrible CGI in the first sequence. The battle sequence at the beginning, which is a sea battle, looks so corny. It made the Sword and Sandals movies of the 60s look much better in its technical prowess. And then they flood the arena, of course, which they used to do in old Rome. But Ridley Scott adds CGI sharks. CGR sharks. So it's not bad enough to be a gladiator that's mauled on some point, but when you fell off this boat in the flooded arena, you're then consumed by a CGI shark in a field of blood. When I saw the sharks, I nearly lost it. It was just too much, a little bit too long, and it took away from the good performances of Denzel and Pascal and Mescal.
Were there nude gladiators?
Well, no, but there was an occasional breast on a beautiful girl, including that of Lucius's first wife, which is played by a wonderful, I believe she's Egyptian actress, partially Egyptian. She's been in some great Hebrew and Egyptian. She's been in The Missing, The Station. Her name is Yuval Gonen, and she's a gorgeous woman with beautiful eyes. You get to see a little of her there before they shove an arrow right between the two, setting the whole thing in motion for the revenge.
How do we get in touch with you?
Matthias Bombals Hollywood on Facebook. That's M-A-T-I-A-S B-O-M-B-A-L Hollywood, like the city. M-A-T-I-A-S-B-O-M-B-A-L, Hollywood, on Facebook. And many, many good greetings to your family, Walter, and that of our listener right here on this great program for Thanksgiving wishes.
Happy Thanksgiving, Matthias. You're a good friend of the show and a good friend to me. Thank you. This is Sterling Every Damn Sunday.
There's some straight girls here right now who are like, oh my god, oh my god, I played softball in high school, I was third base and I was really good, what does this mean?
It means you're gay! We're coming for you, grab the Subaru, let's go!
Sterling on Sunday. Coming up.
Have a plan for Black Friday. The people of Walmart. Later. Sterling every damn night.
I'm smutty book author Thea Landon, and I have a late night story for Midnight Misfits on Sterling every damn night.
Dancers, know your rights. Later. Strippers on the loose. Sterling every damn night.
Sterling on Sunday, inspired by Frank Rizzo.
Get away from me, you crumb.
Wow. And he died on the air. His final wish was granted. Now, I got a rotten cold, and this morning it wasn't bad, or else I would have called Gary Arnell around noon. But now it's terrible. There's Stephen and Selena, my favorites. They own JB Bakery in Burlington, New Jersey, which is near the shore, down the shore. But this is a bakery like your grandmother's bakery. You walk in, it smells like a grandmother bakery. Oh, look at you. How cute are you? That's a cute outfit. Do you want some cookies? And you say yes. And then you say, can I have more? And they'll say yes, because it's JB Bakery in Burlington, New Jersey. What I love about these guys, and they don't pay for this time, it's not a commercial. What I love about these guys is they run their business. Stephen and Selena run the business. They're there. I suspect Stephen's there all the time. And he bakes most of the cool stuff. And he's very fussy with ingredients and content. And I have a recipe from him for pumpkin bread. Now, he's going to want to talk about another recipe, but we're not doing a different recipe tonight. We're just doing the pumpkin bread. Great response, exactly the right time of year. And you, my friend, need a simple recipe to take to the annoying in-laws and show off. Stephen, what you got cooking?
Hey, Walter. Yes, I'm right. I've been up all night making pumpkin bread for Thanksgiving dinners. People are really enjoying the pumpkin bread. It's you can enjoy it like a cake or a snack, have it for breakfast. And what's unique about my pumpkin bread is that I like to use pumpkin that I purchased the year before. So what I do is I stock up on cans of pumpkin, and I only, like, you're right, I use good pumpkin. I'm starting to get bashed sometimes because my menu, my prices are a little higher than other big box retailers of some of their Thanksgiving items. But if you take a look at the cans of pumpkin that they're using, is actually from China. I use American pumpkin, American grown pumpkin. That's twice the price of this China stuff that they're getting. So, you know, that's what I try to tell my customers. I try to educate my customers that I use good quality products, good quality pumpkin, and that's what it takes. You got to get this pumpkin a year ahead of time and bake it because it'll give a rich, dark color. It actually ages in color. It doesn't go bad. Everybody knows that you get stocked up on canned goods. So that's what I like to use. And what's fun about pumpkin bread is that you can add on anything you want. You can bake it plain, or, Walter, you could add on walnuts, chocolate chips, even maybe some coconut. I like to use pecans myself. I like that rich flavor the pecans bring. And it's delicious, and it's great for Thanksgiving dinner. Put it on the table. This way you could almost like snack on a little piece of pumpkin bread. It's almost like cake. So it's like you're eating like dessert before the Thanksgiving dinner is over, and you're waiting for dessert. So that's why I like having pumpkin bread at Thanksgiving.
You can get the recipe. Send me a note, Walter M. Sterling at Gmail, and I will send you the recipe and pictures of the pumpkin bread. Selena and Steven, how is it that you're not fat?
We're working our buns off at the bakery, so, you know, I guess it's just all the moving around, trying to make pies. I mean, this time of the year, especially during the holidays, we're just always doing something at the shop. There's really no time to eat anything, and even if we are, a slice of pie does not compare to the amount of calories you'd burn running around the hot bakery all day. So that's probably why. But then also, I think there's just so much to choose from. I mean, you kind of get sick after you eat a couple pieces of pie, so you really can only have a few a day.
We like to taste test, take a little bite of everything, and then sell the rest to the customers. We got to make sure the quality control is up to par. It's got to be perfect. Right, Selena?
Definitely taste test is the best way to go.
Selena and Steven of JB Bakery in Burlington, New Jersey. Are you two going to be put at the children's table where you're going for Thanksgiving?
I like to make my own table any time I go. I like to sit in the fire, in front of the fire. Selena asked me today, where do you like to sit at Thanksgiving dinner? I prefer a sit-down dinner, but sometimes it doesn't always happen. So she agrees that the fireplace is a nice place to be in front of and enjoying dinner.
Do you think there will be an annoying relative there, maybe one who drinks too much or talks too much about politics?
What do you think,
Selena? I just hope that I won't be the annoying one. That's all I care about. It doesn't matter as long as it's not me.
Is that a possibility, Selena? Could you possibly become the annoying relative at Thanksgiving?
I don't know. I'm not sure. But I wouldn't want to accidentally become the annoying relative. I don't think so. But, you know, that tends to happen to people. Usually they don't know they're the annoying one.
Are either of you going to bring up the result of your cookie poll, where two-thirds more people bought the Trump cookie versus the Harris cookie? Will you be bringing that up?
I'll certainly bring it up. It's fun to talk about. Unfortunately, there's nobody in my family that would probably argue against me. Everybody that has argued against me in the past about those kind of politics have already left the state. They're in other states now. And they refuse to come back to New Jersey because they just feel that their cookies taste better in another state than my cookies. So that's where we stand on that. But I'm always up for a good argument. But sometimes I might think that I'm the annoying one. That's why I only get invited every once a year.
See, that's our problem. Being from New Jersey is what you just said. Quote, I'm always up for an argument, end quote. And I am too. And my shock and sadness is that the rest of the country just doesn't think like that. They're horrified when people randomly make up arguments. That person's gone by the next time they're supposed to get together. But here's how it goes, Stephen. If somebody doesn't argue with me, I don't trust them. If I say something stupid to get an argument going and they don't bite, I don't trust them.
Walter, the worst thing somebody could probably say to me at Thanksgiving is, wow, did you see those pumpkin pies at Sam's Club? They're 12 inches, and they're only $5. I'm like, do you have any idea what they put in those pies? They might actually taste good, but do you have any idea what they put in those pies? It's like, don't eat those. You got to eat really good, high-quality pumpkin made at a real bakery, or go to at least a diner by your house and patronize a diner. They use good quality stuff.
It's interesting, Stephen, the Jersey diners always have good pumpkin pie. If they have no other pie, they'll have pumpkin pie or apple. But the pumpkin pie is always perfect. Stephen and Selena, JB Bakery, get the pumpkin bread recipe. It's WalterMSterling@gmail.com, and I will send it to you, WalterMSterling@gmail.com, for the pumpkin bread recipe. Stephen and Selena, you are dear friends of mine and the show, and I wish you both the happiest Thanksgiving. All right,
happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. 855-839-1210. That's my phone number. 855-839-1210. As you can hear, I have the tsunami cold. I don't feel as bad as it sounds, and it's not as serious as it sounds. It's just a common cold. And that led me to a conspiracy theory. Wait a minute. They, and you know who they are, they have not cured the common cold yet. I bet they cured it 70 years ago and realized that that would be bad for business. But think about it. All the things they have been able to cure, and they can't cure a cold. And whenever they're asked, they say, well, it's a very complicated virus. I don't think it's very complicated. And its pathology is well known. I'm Walter Sterling. This is Sterling every damn Sunday.
10 years of OK Radio, repulsive to the talk radio community. Billie Eilish fashions, courtesy of Idaho. Tonight, lesbians, strippers, and other ratings grabbers. I'm your announcer, James Copeland.
Yeah, it's true that Alice has died. And also, we all finally know how to pronounce Hegseth. I'm Walter M. Sterling, and here's Dr. Dave's Thanksgiving weather.
All news, more news. Day and night around the clock, it's your news. You get it all when you set your dial to Sterling every damn night. Sterling every damn night. Sterling every damn night.
Good evening, good evening. It's 8 minutes past the hour, 8 minutes past the hour. Coast to coast, Walter M. Sterling. How exciting to be with you. And the big news, of course, is that Alice has died. And she was a great cook, a dear friend, a remarkable person in every way. Alice died. What? Who's Alice?
This song is called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago, it was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant, she lives in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower with her husband Ray and Facha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they got a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And having all that room, seeing as how they took out all the pews, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, we found all the garbage in there, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the city dump. Well, we got there, and there's a big sign and a chain across the dump saying closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one. Till we came to a side road, and off the side of the side road was another 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile's better than two little piles, and rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, "Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage, and wanted to know if you had any information about it." And I said, "Yes, sir, Officer Obey, cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage." After speaking to Obey for about 45 minutes on the telephone, we finally arrived at the truth of the matter and said that we had to go down and pick up the garbage, and also had to go down and speak to him at the police officer station. So we got in the red VW microbus with the shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, headed on toward the police officer station. Now, friends, there was only one or two things that Obi could have done at the police station, and the first was that he could have given us a medal for being so brave and honest on the telephone, which wasn't very likely, and we didn't expect it. Another thing was that he could have bawled us out and told us never to be seen driving garbage around the vicinity again, which is what we expected. But when we got to the police officer station, there was a third possibility that we hadn't even counted upon, and we was both immediately arrested, handcuffed. And I said, "Obi, I don't think I can pick up the garbage with these handcuffs on." He said, "Shut up, kid. Get in the back of the patrol car." And that's what we did. Sat in the back of the patrol car and drove to the, quote, scene of the crime, unquote. I want to tell you about the town of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where this happened. Here they got three stop signs, two police officers, and one police car. But when we got to the scene of the crime, there was five police officers and three police cars, being the biggest crime of the last 50 years, and everybody wanted to get in a newspaper story about it. And they was using up all kinds of cop equipment that they had hanging around the police officer station. They was taking plaster, tire track, footprints, dogs smelling prints, and they took 27 8x10 colored glossy photographs with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. Took pictures of the approach, the getaway, the northwest corner, the southwest corner, and that's not to mention the aerial photography. After the ordeal, we went back to the jail. Obi said he was gonna put us in the cell. Said, "Kid, I'm gonna put you in the cell. I want your wallet and your belt." And I said, "Obi, I can understand you want my wallet so I don't have any money to spend in the cell, but what do you want my belt for?" And it said, "Kid, we don't want any hangings." Said, "Obi, did you think I was gonna hang myself for littering?" Obi said he was making sure, and friends, Obi was, because he took out the toilet seat so I couldn't hit myself over the head and drown. And he took out the toilet paper so I couldn't bend the bars, roll the toilet paper out the window, slide down the roll, and have an escape. Obi was making sure, and it was about 4 or 5 hours later that Alice, remember Alice? It's a song about Alice. Alice came by and with a few nasty words to Obi on the side, bailed us out of jail. We went back to the church, had another Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, and didn't get up until the next morning when we all had to go to court. We walked in, sat down. Obi came in with the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back each one. Sat down. man came in, said, "All right." So we all stood up, and Obie stood up with the 27.8x10 covered glossy pictures, and the judge walked in, sat down with the CNI dog, and he sat down. We sat down. Obie looked at the CNI dog. And then the 27.8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and looked at the CNI dog. And then the 27.8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and began to cry, because Obie came to the realization that it was a typical case of American blind justice, and there was nothing he could do about it. And the judge wasn't going to look at the 27.8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. And we was fined $50 and had to pick up the garbage in the snow, but that's not what I came to tell you about. Came to talk about the draft. Got a building down New York City, it's called Whitehall Street, where you walk in and you get injected, inspected, detected, infected, neglected, and selected. I went down to get my physical examination one day, and I walked in, I sat down, got good and drunk the night before, so I looked and felt my best when I went in that morning. Cause I wanted to look like the all-American kid from New York City. Man, I wanted to feel like I wanted to be the all-American kid from New York. And I walked in, sat down, I was hung down, brung down, hung up, and all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. And I walked in, I sat down, they gave me a piece of paper, said, "Kid, see the psychiatrist, room 604. And I went up there, I said, "Shrink, I want to kill. I want to kill. Kill. I want to see blood and gore and guts and veins in my teeth. Eat dead, burnt bodies. I mean, kill. 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 Kill." And I started jumping up and down, yelling, "Kill. Kill." And it started jumping up and down with me, and we was both jumping up and down, yelling, "Kill. Kill." And the sergeant came over, pinned the medal on me, set me down the hall, said, "You're our boy. Feel too good about it." Proceeded on down the hall, getting more injections, inspections, detections, neglections, and all kinds of stuff that they was doing to me at the thing there. And I was there for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. I was there for a long time, going through all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things, and I was just having a tough time there. And they was inspecting, injecting every single part of me, and they was leaving no part untouched. Proceeded through, and I when finally came to see the very last man. I walked in, sat down after a whole big thing there, and I walked up and said, "What do you want?" He said, "Kid, we only got one question. Have you ever been arrested?" I proceeded to tell him the story of Alice's restaurant, Massa Cree, with full orchestration, a five-part harmony and stuff like that, and then all the phenomena stopped me right there and said, "Kid, did you ever go to court?" I proceeded to tell him the story of the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one. It stopped me right there and said, "Kid, I want you to go over and sit down on that bench that says Group W. Now, kid." I walked over to the bench there, and there's Group W is where they put you. If you may not be moral enough to join the army after committing your special crime, and there was all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly-looking people on the bench there. Mother rapers. Father stabbers. Father rapers. Father rapers sitting right there on the bench next to me, and one, it was mean and nasty and ugly and horrible and crime-fighting. rotten guys are sitting there on the bench. And the meanest, ugliest, nastiest one, the meanest father raper of them all, was coming over to me, and he was mean and ugly and nasty and horrible and all kinds of things. And he sat down next to me and said, "Kid, what'd you get?" I said, "I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $50 and pick up the garbage." I said, "What were you arrested for, kid?" And I said, "Littering." And they all moved away from me on the bench there, the hairy eyebone, all kinds of mean, nasty things, till I said, "And creating a nuisance." And they all came back, shook my hand, and we had a great time on the bench talking about crime, mother stabbing, father raping, all kinds of groovy things that we was talking about on the bench. And everything was fine, we were smoking cigarettes and all kinds of things, until the sergeant came over, had some paper in his hand, held it up and said, "Kids, this piece of paper's got 47 words, 37 sentences, 58 words. We want to know details of the crime, time, crime, and all the kind of thing you got to say, pretend to about the crime. Want to know the rest of the officer's name, and all the kind of thing you got to say." And it talked for 45 minutes, and nobody understood a word that he said. But we had fun filling out the forms and playing with the pencils on the bench there. I filled out the massacre with the four-part harmony and wrote it down there just like it was, and everything was fine. And I put down a pencil and I turned over the piece of paper, and there on the other side, in the middle of the other side, away from everything else on the other side, in parentheses, capital letters, quotated, read the following words: "Kid, you rehabilitated yourself." I went over to the sergeant and said, "Sergeant, you've got a lot of damn gall to ask me if I've rehabilitated myself. I'm sitting here on the bench. I mean, I'm sitting here on the Group W bench, 'cause you want to know if I'm moral enough to join army, burn women, kids, houses, and villages after being a litter bug." He looked at me and said, "Kid, you don't like your kind. And we're gonna send your fingerprints off to Washington, and friends, somewhere in Washington, enshrined in some little folders, a study in black and white of my fingerprints. And the only reason I'm singing you the song now is 'cause you may know somebody in a similar situation, or you may be in a similar situation. And if you're in a situation like that, there's only one thing you can do, is walk into the shrink wherever you are. Just walk in, say, 'Shrink, you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant,' and walk out. You know, if one person, just one person does it, they may think he's really sick and they won't take him. And if two people do it in harmony, they think they're both faggots and it won't take either of them. And if three people do it, can you imagine three people walking in, singing a bar, Alice's restaurant, and walking out? They may think it's an organization. And can you imagine 50 people a day? I said 50 people a day walking in, singing a bar, Alice's restaurant, and walking out. And friends, they may think it's a movement. And that's what it is. The Alice's Restaurant Anti-Massacre Movement. And all you gotta do to join is to sing it the next time it comes around on the guitar with feeling. So we'll wait till it comes around on the guitar here. Sing it when you're done.
CELMINS. That is the cure for my bad breath. I use it when I eat onions, Indian food, garlic.
Sterling on Sunday. inspired by Sniper Wolf.
Hello, friends. It's me. Yes, I cut my hair. TikTok saw it first. I always wanted to cut my hair, so I did.
Day and night around the clock, it's your news. You get it all when you set your dial to serve every damn night.
It's 36 past the hour, 36 past the hour. Walter M. Sterling, good evening. It's a live radio show, and my phone number is 855-839-1210. And Ed Till is a famous talk show host and stand-up comic, but has done something that I have tried to do for many years. I have wanted to write a book, Ed, and every time I try to write a book, I'm like, I start writing radio stories. And I'm like, there are going to be six guys at a bar that want to hear radio stories, or worse, at a convention. And you have mastered the art of writing a book that is of interest to people who are not in radio.
Well, you know, it's a gruesome assignment. By the way, great to be with you, Walter.
Thank you, sir.
Joining you on the show. And to you and your beautiful family, and you put many great pictures I admire. But it's an interesting thing that I have always been one of those six guys at the bar who wants to know more about vaudeville or radio or William B. Williams or something, you know, from way back. And even when I was starting out, I just had a real interest, a proactive, organic interest in all of that. So I said, right, same thing you. I said, you cannot write this book for five people. And also, there's a darkness to when you write your story that everybody's waiting for. You know, whether you're up against this disastrous moment or this catastrophic development, and how you grind it and you impact on the whole Leave It to Beaver thing falls apart, wives, kids, addresses, dogs, the whole thing goes upside down. Somehow at the end, you're, you know, paddling toward a light, and I loathe those stories. I'm sure the first beginning of the genre, but for me now, I can't read that. So I wanted to write for the person that's in the break room visiting the station because their client is in there cutting a spot, and they have no idea where they are, what's going on, and I would love to chat them up in front of the refrigerator. So this book is 40 years, 40 stories that you could tell in the break room to somebody who knows nothing about radio. All of these highs, lows, ups and downs, wild. You know, I'm an enthusiastic human being. So when things are great, I love that wave. And then when things are not great, navigating the rough waters are even more exhilarating. So there's an energy here that ties into the whole stand-up thing. Stand-up thing is very high energy on stage. This book is high energy.
What's the name of the book? Yeah, what's the name of the book?
The title of the book is Hired Tongue, The Talk Radio Adventures of the Ed Till Show.
Now, Ed Till is a big star in Orlando, Florida. He's been in all the big cities. He's very successful and, may I say, highly respected talk show host. In your experience, what was the very best thing that happened to you in radio?
Phone call is always, the whole book is full of them. So with me, it's always a phone call, unexpected, that changes my address, my life, my everything. And this phone call came late August And usually nothing is going on in late August in the business. But here it is, and this is in the book, the phone call. And the phone call is one of your legendary heroes of talk radio is thinking about retiring, always mentions you, and is going on vacation. How would you like to sit in for an afternoon drive in the number one market in the world, your hometown, to your Aunt Addie and Uncle Louie and Aunt Norma, and everybody can hear Edward? And, of course, I fell down to the floor, jumped on the flight. They sent me the whole thing. It's the old days. We get a package of paper with your itinerary, and I ran. I got there, and the day before, so the show's going to be the whole week, Monday through Friday. So Sunday, I get a hold of everybody in my life from the playground, grammar school, everybody, and we're hanging out, and we can't believe I'm doing this, and this is what it's all come to, and my age is right, the millennium is right, everything is right, wow. So I go do the show, and they fall in love with me. A sales guy's, oh my God, the way you do a spot. A news girl, oh my God, you went to that high school. Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, this is not happening, and it's only Monday. I got 5 days of this. So of course, this is it. I'm playing for the Knicks now. I'm some kind of, you know, jump shooter. Great, no one's ever heard of me, but I'm here. I'm from the Bronx. And 9/11 was the next day.
Right?
I mean, right. Just, you know, the universe just said, you know, I want to let you see what it was like. Did you feel it? Yes, I felt it. Did you do it? Yes, I did it. Did you use your best material? Yes, I did. But the world's going to, you know, Guy Bin Laden's really got a thing, and it's all happening on your day. And, you know, nothing was ever the same. Station reorganized, so, you know, all the kind of upheaval that is so profound. That, you know, you don't even contemplate the future. You just go, wow, I was there. That was what it was all about.
I'm impressed that the host called you himself.
Yeah, right.
Not HR, not a secretary, not a general manager. I'm impressed with that. And right. I also had the experience of being on that station. And right before I sat in that chair to calm me down, the board op talked back to me and he goes, remember, you're sitting in a really big chair. I'm like, oh, thanks for telling me that. That's the last thing I need to hear. Oh, my God. Exactly. Now, that was almost the best and the worst thing to happen to you. What was, like, the worst thing to happen to you in radio?
You know, I'm trying to think now to get a good one.
Right? Sure.
Because it's you and me. We've been around together for so long. So a really, really good one would be, okay, here we go. So I love all this. Listen, we're taking this station in L.A. in a whole different direction, and you're part of it. We were in town. We heard you, and we didn't even have our meeting because you're so great. You have to be on. I said, I'm there. You know, paperwork, sure. And the deal is going through. And I can't believe what's going on. And my old friend, whom I love, Larry Elder, along with another old friend of mine who I truly love, came on my show in 1984. So we're talking 40 years ago. Jesse Jackson, they gave me a heads up. Listen, tomorrow, you know we love you, but tomorrow we're going to the L.A. Times and say you can't have that show. Because, you know, Larry's black and Larry's conservative and, you know, I'm liberal and, you know, I'm black. And I'm like, you know, you guys are black. Totally. I get it. You know, I said, but, you know, my contract and, you know, the station, they said, well, listen, you know, a lot of things are going to. So I got that and my stomach fell because I knew, I mean, you know, when you're at that level, what could go well here? What could possibly go
right.
Well, and of course, the show got cut in half. Then the new guy, the guys who thought I was fantastic, both left the same day. And I saw them at the elevator. I'm like, wow. Well, what? They look really upset. And I found out that was they were leaving at that moment for good. And a new guy came in. Says, well, listen, it's not your fault. No, don't worry, that's not your fault. I ran away.
All right, this is Ed Till, who's written a book called Hired Tongue. Ed Till, T-Y-L-L. You can buy his book, and you should buy his book, because it'll be a good time. And you're going to have a long vacation coming up soon. You're going to have the Christmas holiday. Get a new book. This is a good book that's the kind you can pick up and put down, and it has great stories in it. Ed Till, T-Y-L-L, Hired Tongue. I am proud of you that you wrote a book. This is really great. Who is the best manager you ever worked for?
Well, you know, this is really tough because there were some magical moments. The guy who managed that moment I just described to you was so into it. I mean, we went in a car ride together. He showed me NYPD Blue. He shot here. I mean, we were just, so there was that management style that David had, David Bernstein. But there was incredible management from Bob Moore, K 97.1.
Yeah,
thank
KLSX.
You, KLSX. Bob Moore's time there. And of course, I mean, you know, Mark Lass, as you and I talked about,
was
Jefferson. You need a writer? I got this guy, Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
So when you're founding a thing, which you, I mean, that's, look, you're Steve Jobs, you're a Wozniak, I get it, you know, Musk and all these guys, you're in there, and everybody knew it, but now it's so interesting to be down the road a bit and see the depth of, mark that you have made with that whole thing.
The whole idea of it,
that you're like, go for it, go for it. So,
I will leave you with this story. This is a Bob Moore story. Bob Moore is a flamboyant manager in Los Angeles, ran many radio stations in Los Angeles, a personality-driven manager. I'm witnessing him conduct a sales meeting. He's at the front of the room conducting a sales meeting. And he says, all right, now you got to do this, and if you do this, and if none of that works, you get to do the best thing that a salesman gets to do, you lie. And I love Bob Moore. Ed Till, Hired Tongue, Hired Tongue, thank you very much for being on Sterling every damn Sunday.
It's the people of Walmart on Sterling at night.
Friday, millions of Americans will be going to Walmart to get amazing Black Friday values and bargains, and a wide variety of bargains there are. They're different depending on which area of the country you're in. Check out your local Walmart store. Let me just tell you, you're going to save a whole lot of money on Black Friday, but you have to go in with a plan, and you don't want anything slowing you down. No kids. And for the ladies, probably not your husband, but he can be conveniently located to pick you up after you're done with your shopping. Have knee pads ready. Have elbow pads ready to go, because any good value disappears right away. And as you're rushing into that Walmart, you may have to elbow somebody out of the way. And I think that's totally fair behavior on Black Friday. It's every human for themselves. Every woman, every man, leave the children at home. And those Walmart associates, they're busy just trying to keep the fights from happening. Seemingly every year in every community, there's a few fist fights on Black Friday. Get in there, get out, don't get into a confrontation with anyone, leave when you're done shopping. And ladies, your husband should not be in there shopping with you. He should, though, drive you and wait in the car for a quick getaway. And husbands, if your wife wants you to go in, promise that you'll go into the store, but first you want to drop her off right up front, and then you'll go and look for a parking spot, and it'll take you an hour to find a parking spot, even if you get one in 30 seconds. Have a plan. Black Friday, make members of your family and on your gift list very happy. For the people of Walmart, this is Velo Hool, Sterling every damn night.
54 past the hour, Walter M. Sterling driving across 81-95. Welcome. This is the only live show on the radio right now. It's just you and me. You don't fit in. I don't fit in. That's why we're here. When I started out in radio a couple hours ago, I was I always looked forward to Thanksgiving because I'd be home from college, and I knew there were people who needed time off at a local radio station, and that meant I got to work. I did anything I could to work, and one of the things I did to work was I wanted to work at the radio station in a summer job. And when I went to the owner of the station, I said, I'll do Thanksgiving fill-ins, whatever you need, for free. And I didn't say, so you'll hire me in the summer. I just did it. And I showed up. I did a good show for free. And sure enough, that summer, I got a summer job at the radio station, which was golden. And but it's always very exciting to work at a holiday. It used to be, listen to this, it used to be that radio stations had big Thanksgiving contests, turkey shoots on the air. They used to have big Thanksgiving contests, and that made it fun. And then I realized, I don't think any radio station has weekend contests anymore, because everybody's home. You know, it's the program by automation, which is tragic. Guys, it's tragic, and it's unnecessary. And there are a zillion people who'd like to be on the air and, quote, quote, get into radio, and you could pay them minimum wage and have a farm team. They always talk about a farm team. Where's the farm team? Well, guess what? There never was a farm team. There was never a recruitment of people to be on the radio, to be disc jockey. That never existed. What always existed was kids would hang around the stations. That's what happened. They'd go into the station and hang around till somebody said, sweep this floor. Could you erase this? Would you check this log against what went on the air? They gave them tasks to see if they would do them. Not to see if they'd do them well, listen carefully, not to say they'd do them well, but that they showed enthusiasm for doing them at all. And that's how a farm team was built. It was never complicated, but what's made it complicated is my least favorite law, which is Sarbanes-Oxley. Sarbanes-Oxley, I am the only person you know who's read the law. I have read it because I couldn't believe how restrictive it was. The reason you have to get a photo ID when you go into one of those big buildings to go see some big company in a tall office building, you know why you have to get photo IDs? It's not because they're afraid you're going to steal a pencil. It's so that they can document who's in the building and when to be in compliance for Sarbanes-Oxley. But Sarbanes-Oxley doesn't say that. It doesn't say they have to get the photos. It doesn't say anything like that. All it says is that a company has to know who can see their financials at any given time, who has access to their financials, and therefore could have the ability to tamper with their financials. That's it. That's all it is. Instead, as a result, kids can't hang around the building. Instead, kids can't hang around the radio station. They have to be vetted and ID'd and all sorts of crap. It's the stupidest law. It really is a stupid law. Because the way everybody got into radio was they hung around the radio station. That's all we knew. It was a sad, sad life. And maybe one of the disc jockeys would, like, buy us lunch. And to this day, I wish one of the talk show hosts would buy me lunch. You think that'll happen? I don't know. Dave Scott has information for us about UFOs in seconds, Sterling, every damn Sunday.
10 years of OK Radio, repulsive to the talk radio community. Billie Eilish fashions, courtesy of Idaho. Tonight, lesbians, strippers, and other ratings grabbers. I'm your announcer, James Copeland.
Finally, we know how to pronounce Hegseth. I find that to be a relief. Coming up in seconds, UFO news. UFO news.
Control, take a shot.
what I'm looking forward to, Dave Scott? I'm looking forward to a urban campfire story. I want you to tell me a scary story. Could you do that tonight?
Oh, what would you like? Do you want aliens? Do you want Bigfoot? Do you want ghosts, Walter? I'll give you whatever you want.
I think we haven't heard about ghosts in a long time. How about that, Dave Scott? A Canadian, a known Canadian.
Well, let me tell you a spooky ghost story then.
Yes, sir.
In my area of the 108-mile ranch in British Columbia, it is one of the most haunted locations in British Columbia. Now, this is a place where there is all sorts of activity due to the old Gold Rush Trail, which started in Virginia City, Nevada, with the Silver Rush in the 1800s. And then when gold started getting discovered north, it would literally move the ghosts or the people up towards Alaska, the Yukon, and way northern BC, all looking for their gold. It is a very, very interesting place because along that trail, everything seems to be haunted, Walt. So let me get into it for you.
Yes, please.
One night, go ahead.
No, I said, yes, please go. Tell us.
Okay. So we have this old Clydesdale barn at the museum that we have there. And it is one of the oldest and only largest A-frame buildings in the world. And inside this place on the upstairs, there is a catwalk. And we have a ghost there that is beyond scary. So this ghost, we don't know his name. We've never asked it. But I can tell you this. He knows his power. And we were able to find out that we, after photographing him twice, that he got really upset with us. So we were in the barn one night during one of our ghost tours that we did. And all of a sudden, this young girl starts feeling sick. And she is like keeling over ill. I get her out of the building. And little did I know that that ghost from the upstairs actually attached itself to me. And I went outside to help her and took her outside. And I was talking in a different voice as well as I was keeled over, vomiting on the ground because this spirit was inside of me and I had no control of my body. I have no idea to this day how I walked the 150 yards to the main house to where somebody was able to help me, where I collapsed on the ground. And I had to get a shaman who happened to be at the museum that day to actually clear this spirit out of me. After it was cleared, we went back into the barn because I'm a sucker for punishment. And we went upstairs to the catwalk to where this gentleman stays. And my friend Carrie, who was one of my tour guides, walked up the stairs with me. And she looks at me and she goes, I want to go down. I said, where do you see him? She goes, he's right in front of me. I turn and look. I don't see anything. I then get Carrie to face me. And she actually watched his face come out of my head right towards her, like he was going to attack her. And her and I were only about 18 inches away, maybe. And she ran down the stairs, and to this day, she has never been back at the barn or the museum.
How did you feel when that was done?
When it got cleared from me, it felt like the worst hangover I have ever had. Now, to clear a spirit from the body is very, very difficult because that spirit does not want to let go. It has full control over you. And I had to go through a shamanic presence where they had sage all around me and Palo Santo wood burning and doing prayers and everything. And I was screaming and yelling. It was like I was possessed.
You were possessed?
Yes.
Do you remember anything that the spirit, the demon, said to you?
Not a thing. Not a thing.
This is the great Dave Scott. a known Canadian. He runs a radio show and a website called spacedoutradio.com. On YouTube, Spaced Out Radio, see a zillion of his episodes, his videos. Worth it. You want to subscribe and click like, and he will be with us tomorrow night in Philadelphia for Sterling Every Damn Night. Is that right, Mr. Scott?
I'm here every day for you, my man. Why? Because the Midnight Misfits love a good spooky story.
I look forward to the one tomorrow night. Let's do another spooky story tomorrow night. That was great. Okay?
Not a problem. We can do that.
All right. You're the best. Dave Scott, Sterling Every Damn Sunday. Let's be on the floor. In space.
In space. Coming out isn't easy, but I'm not coming out. You kind of are. I don't know why you're trying to fight it.
Sterling on Sunday, inspired by old guys.
The Babylon Bee, in tragic comedic fashion, captured the moment perfectly. Man ruled too senile to stand trial, still fine to run country.
All right, good evening. It's 855-839-1210, 855-839-1210. Walter Sterling with this bizarre cold, this strange cold. I was fine this morning, and now I wish Gary Arnell had taken the reins tonight. But listen, on Thanksgiving Day, I'm doing a show, and I'm doing it on our affiliate WPHT in Philadelphia. Get the Odyssey app, and you will hear an actual Thanksgiving show. No one else does that. I don't know what they're doing, but it's not going to be as good as this. Get the Odyssey app. Download it, and then click on WPHT. Same time, I'll be on from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m., because this is our time. This is the time when we belong together. It's why I'm on the radio at this time. If they said, hey, Mr. Sterling, would you do morning drive? Would you like to? No. The answer is no. Every city. Oh, I said Odyssey app. Every city. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. It is the worst name for the best company. There's no better company in radio than Odyssey. Couldn't be happier. But what a terrible name, because no one knows how to pronounce it or say it. It's like Pete Hegseth. Nobody knew how to pronounce that until this week. Every city has places that only natives know. And natives aren't in a big hurry to show the tourists. In New York City, in Manhattan, where I lived for a long time, there's a meat market called the Florence Meat Market on Great Jones Street in Greenwich Village, the heart of Greenwich Village. And you wouldn't look twice at it when you walk by, but if you went in, you would step back to the 1920s. This meat market has not changed since the 1920s. I believe it's had the same ownership family since the 1920s. You go in there, and there are two world-class butchers within sight. You see them doing their work. You see them being artists. They know exactly what they're doing. They don't have to think about it. And whatever cut of meat you want, that's what you'll get. They're the best. This is aged meat, American meat, and this is the best butcher ever. It's called the Florence Meat Market. Now, the Florence Meat Market does something really interesting at Thanksgiving, and it's a way to identify true New Yorkers. First, you have to know about this, and nobody's in a big hurry to tell anybody. But if you want a turkey, and you do, from the Florence Meat Market, the turkey you're going to get is coated in bacon grease and wrapped in bacon. Right there, you're way ahead. They'll stuff it with anything you want. You could tell them whatever stuffing you want. That beautiful sausage, no problem. Hot sausage, sweet sausage. And by the way, New Yorkers, as opposed to the rest of the world, New Yorkers have sweet sausage on their pizza. They don't have spicy sausage on their pizza, because then it overwhelms the taste. Then all you're going to do is taste the sausage. And a true pizzeria wants you to taste the melange of flavors. Do you like that word? The melange of flavors. And they want you to taste the seasoning and the grease and the cheese and the ultra thin crust. That's a New York pizza. And if you say, I want sausage on it, you will get sausage, but it's sweet sausage. It blends in with the melange of flavors of the New York pizza. And a true New York pizza, you could hold it up to the light and see the light through the crust. That's how thin it is. And when you hold it up, pizza grease drips down your arm. And you're not embarrassed. You are proud because you know that you know how to eat pizza the right way. I digress. The Florence Meat Market on Great Jones Street, at Thanksgiving, they sell 300 turkeys and no more. And okay, a week before Thanksgiving, I'll go in and reserve my turkey. No, you won't. In October, you're going to reserve your turkey? No, you won't. You have to do what I did 2 years in a row. You have to walk in there in August when it's 100 degrees out. You walk in there in August and you look at the manager lady and you look at her and say, I want to be number one. Because you see, what the Florence Meat Market does is with the reservation made for turkeys by each person, they print out their name and they post it on a cork board behind the counter from 300 to 1. They're posted. And the first person to make a reservation is number one. As a New Yorker, to this day, my 22-year-old is blown away. As a New Yorker, I was like, I'm going to be number one. And I was for 2 years in a row. Well, who else was up there? I mean, is this just a bunch of goofballs? Steller Adler, world famous artist. Mimi Sheridan, the New York Times food critic for decades, the feared New York Times food critic for decades. World-class names were up there, people who knew that this is where you get your turkey and knew you had better get it done by September 15th. I think September 15th was about as late as it went before the 300 turkeys were claimed. Now, it's still not a simple process. You can't just walk in. Because what? You need the turkey the day before Thanksgiving. You don't need it a week ahead. You're not going to freeze that turkey. You need it the day before Thanksgiving, and on Thanksgiving Day, they're closed. You have to show up the day before Thanksgiving, and oh my gosh, look at the line. I can't believe the line. Now I'm in line in 20-degree weather for my turkey, and I'm number one. And there's Rip Torn, that great comic actor who was in the Gary Shandling show. Rip Torn, he's standing next to me in line. And there's Barbara Streisand standing next to me in line, waiting for their Florence Market turkey. And nobody's complaining. Because we know, just as you can do in your city, there are places you can go and things you can do that nobody else does unless they're a native, unless they've lived there most of their life. They wouldn't know about it. These are the things that we do. They make us feel very special. They make us feel a part of a community that's remarkable. And sure enough, I got my turkey, and I brought it home, and it was world class, and then I did it again the next year. And then sadness befell me. Is that a word? Befell? Yeah. SAT word. Sadness befell me, and we had to move from Manhattan. We had to move from New York. I had to freaking move. That's the one thing I miss most, is the Florence Meat Market on Great Jones Street. I miss that the most. 100-year-old butcher shop, sawdust on the floor. The only meat in their inventory is what they know they're going to sell that day. There's no back there. Everything is sold. And then they close. The Florence Meat Market, best hamburgers ever. The fancy restaurants that are in Greenwich Village, they get their meat from Florence Meat Market, and they get the hamburgers custom from Florence Meat Market. Sounds good, doesn't it? Don't I sound good? That's what's special. Well, let me tell you how sad I am, how pathetic I am. After a couple years of not being able to do Thanksgiving that way, the right way, I didn't want to go to, you know, Kroger's and get a turkey out of the bin. I get turkeys, seafood, and meat from the expensive supermarket. I believe that's what you got to pay for. Everything else, if it's in a can, I'll go to Save-A-Lot. And we're in the Save-A-Lot time of the month. There's the happy side of the month, which is from the 1st to the 10th. That's when I have money from getting paid on the 3rd. And then the rest of the month is the dark side of the month. That's when we go to Save-A-Lot. So at the beginning of the month, I go to the fancy supermarket. At the end of the month, I go to Save-A-Lot. Now, you know what Save-A-Lot is? It is the discount part of Aldi's. Aldi's has a cheaper version. Yes, it's called Save-A-Lot. And oddly, it's well camouflaged against the sky. No matter where Save-A-Lot is, you have to freaking know where it is. And surprisingly, they're great stores. Clean, immaculate, no lines, nobody knows it's there. It's weird. I missed the Florence Meat Market so much. This is so pathetic. I called them once, about a year ago, and I said, I'm just calling you because I miss you. You miss us. I said, yeah, I miss your store. I miss the meat. I miss you. I miss the whole thing. I had to move. We can ship. We ship. And they ship. It was comforting to know. But again, the dark side of the month haunted us. Today I bought a dozen eggs. It was $4. Not the fancy eggs, not the free range chickens. No, these were normal jumbo eggs. I only buy jumbo eggs. I don't know why you'd get any other size. Why would you get any other size? They all cost the same. It was $4. 3 years ago, $1.90 at Dollar Tree. I could get a dozen eggs for $1.90 at Dollar Tree. Now, Dollar Tree doesn't carry eggs because they can't get it close to a dollar. It seems kind of wrong. I have three young, attractive daughters, and therefore I'm always a little worried about trafficking. No, really. And finally, somebody made a great movie about it, and that's coming up in seconds, Sterling Every Damn Night.
All news, more news, day and night around the clock, it's all news. You get it all when you set your dial to Sterling Every Damn Night.
Get cozy with the Al and Dawn.
I'm Smutty Book author Thea Landon, and here's an excerpt from my book, Train Hard, Rest Harder. Once our plates were empty, Kristen leaned back in his chair, swirling the wine in his glass as he studied me. Want to know what I'm thinking? I gulped my drink, hoping it would dampen some of the heat creeping up my neck. Sure. While I had a few doubts at the beginning, you followed all the rules for this trip. Well, most of the time, but knowing how you are, I'm considering it a success. He set the glass on the table, then folded his hands behind his head, the sleeves of his t-shirt caught around his bulky arms. So, I'm going to let you choose how you want to spend the rest of the evening. Whether you want to finish the book you are reading, or go to sleep early to get a good night's rest uninterrupted, it's up to you. My eyebrow arched. Are those my only two options? Letting out a low chuckle, he licked his lips. Fresh wave of arousal cooled between my thighs. Did you have something else in mind? I debated playing more of these coy games, but it wasn't my typical style. We each knew what the other wanted. After finishing the rest of my wine in one swig, I stood. The gold flecks in his eyes glimmered in the dim light as I leaned over him, planting one hand on either side of his shoulders as I gripped the back of his chair. Come to bed with me. Stay the night this time. Tristan snaked a hand around the back of my head, biting me downward. His lips met mine, and I tasted the heady remnants of the wine on his velvety tongue. I inched closer to him, and he broke the kiss, leaving me breathless. "I'll meet you upstairs in a few minutes," he murmured. With the flames blooming inside me, I needed to rid myself of my thick sweatshirt sooner rather than later anyway. Turning around, I sauntered out of the room. "I'll be waiting." In my suite, I rushed through my nighttime routines, shedding my clothing in stages. I looked around the bedroom, debating what sort of scene I wanted to set, and opted for mirroring the previous night. After folding back the covers and fluffing the pillows, I turned off all the lights, save for one of the lamps on the nightstand. Tristan entered the room before I could slip between the sheets. Whirling around, I gasped, resisting the urge to cover myself up. I recovered, though, and stood beside the bed, completely bared to him. "I didn't think you were so impatient," I teased. Saying nothing, he strode across the room until he towered over me. Placing one hand on either side of my face, he claimed my mouth in a fervent kiss, his tongue delving inside. I braced my palms on his broad chest and leaned into him. He pushed against me in return. This time, I pulled away first. I sat down and slid toward the center of the bed. Bunching the pillows beneath my head, I laid on my side and watched him undress. That devilish smirk played upon his lips as he reached for the hem of his t-shirt and yanked it off, the muscles in his arms flexing with the movement. A pale glow from the lamp illuminated every chiseled plane in his chest and torso, the deep ridges drawing my eyes downward. He tugged at the ties at the front of his waistband, loosening the knot and pushing his shorts down over his hips. I didn't know what the future had in store for us, but for the rest of the night, he was mine. The mattress bounced as he hopped onto it and rolled to face me. "So, any specific requests for tonight?" he asked. With one fingertip, I traced a line around his pecs as I considered his question. An idea sprang into my mind, and I hoped the wan lighting would conceal some of my self-consciousness. "I want to watch you." I paused over his heart, feeling the steady thrum of its pulse. "I want to see your face while you're on top of me." I think I'd better stop there for tonight, but you know you can always have more. That was an excerpt from my book, Train Hard, Rest Harder, which is available at Amazon in paperback and on Kindle Unlimited. I'm smutty book author Thea Landon for Sterling every damn night.
Often you hear stories about our exotic dancers being targeted for prostitution. And generally speaking, it's easy to give benefit of the doubt to our boys and girls that serve us in blue, keep our neighborhoods safe. Sometimes, though, it's entrapment. And a lawyer, a wonderful lawyer in Houston, Texas, is giving us some wonderful tips. His name is Jose Seya, and he is an expert on protecting our exotic dancers. And so thus, he is a personal hero of mine. So here's how it works. Undercover cop, poses as a customer at a strip joint attempts to gain the trust of the stripper with the goal of convincing them to offer or accept money in exchange for some sort of sexual act. It's alleged prostitution. Prostitution is a Class B misdemeanor, punishable up to 180 days in the hoosegow. Many states, by the way, have a broad definition of what sex is. It could involve feet. It could involve armpits. It could be involving, yeah, sex. So exotic dancers know the law. If you're jiggle joint, they need to have a lawyer come in and meet with every dancer. Like a quarterly sort of meeting. Like HR. To go over, okay, here's what you can say, here's what you can't say. And a lot of times, exotic dancers just agree to stuff, hoping they can get extra money out of the deal. They'll just sit there and nod away, hoping that gives them an extra $20 tip. Sometimes these happen in the champagne room during negotiations. And realize this, these cops are probably wired. Be safe out there, ladies. From the champagne room, this is Velo Hool. Strippers on the loose, Sterling every damn night.
Sterling on Sunday, inspired by Judge Judy.
You have nice people who invite you for Thanksgiving dinner a month in advance, and then you spring on them the morning that you're coming. We have to bring the dog. It's wonderful with babies. It's wonderful. It doesn't even bark. Do you understand? That's real gall. That's real gall. I'm saying this to the tens of millions of people who will watch this program in repeats, originals, whenever. When I'm long gone, if you're invited to someone's home for an event, and especially if it's a stranger, don't bring or ask to bring your dog.
Sterling, every damn night. Now, several good minutes.
John Devaney is the financier and founder of Manor House Films. Now, think about that. All the fantasies you have of starting your own business, John's done all of that. Successful financier, highly respected, and then the most annoying part, he was born in Key Biscayne and he still lives in Key Biscayne. I'm going to talk to John Devaney about being a successful entrepreneur, and I'm going to talk to him about the essence of this movie. The movie is a gripping tale about one boy, his harrowing journey as he's trafficked from Mexico to a sweatshop in Los Angeles. The film sheds light on the global crisis of child trafficking, which affects over 12 million children.
Back in 1999, my first year, a couple ladies came to me and they had a horse farm in Orlando, and they showed me a video cassette in a TV. They had driven to Key Biscayne, and they said, Mr. Devaney, you know, I was a very young man, 29 years old. They said, look, Factor died and they've lost all the funding and the horses are starving, and these horses are used to give therapy to foster kids and kids with cancer, and we don't know what to do. And we just need $5,000 just to feed the horses. And I looked at the ladies and I was like, $5,000? That's nothing. What are you going to do with that? I was like, and I was really busy doing my trading. I was like, you know, I'll give you $50,000. And that was about halfway through 1999. That was my first year. I kind of told them, here's the money. I got to get back to work. And I sat back down at my desk. And about an hour later, I did a bond trade. And, you know, I'll tell you, I made $250,000 on one trade. And it was the biggest trade I ever did in my life, my whole career up until that point. And it was kind of like, it just seemed like the universe was talking to me, like, you know, you give back. And I'd never donated to anything at that point. And I sat down, and the next week I wrote, go to our website. You know, we have that community reinvestment program. I said, you know what, we're going to give a part of our revenues back. We're going to give it back to the community. And then that year I made $5 million when I was 29 years old. The next year I made $25 million. The next year I made $45 million. I mean, my business absolutely took off. We started trading billions of these products. And I credit some of that to thinking about others and to trying to give back and paying attention to other people. And, you know, that's the one thing. It's like your superpower. When you give 5% of your energy and your time, maybe 10%, okay, it doesn't have to be your money. You could just decide to give back with your voice, just like I'm doing right now. You know, I'm using my voice to raise awareness for the children that don't have any voice. Okay, so it could be your creativity. It could be your time. You could write an email. Okay, and you can advocate for something. There's so many ways to give back.
How does it work that a kid is plucked from the Mexican border and put in a sweatshop in Los Angeles and nobody knows about it?
There were the cartel that had run Facebook ads. They've now been taken down. But in 2021 and 22, they were running Facebook ads in Guatemala and Ecuador and Peru. And they were offering families the opportunity to take their children to the United States to give them a better life. And so these poor families paid $3,000 to $5,000 thinking that their children their precious children could have a better life in the United States. Okay. Now, as a parent, and we're both parents, I could never dream of letting my kid go, but there's really horrible conditions and poverty there. And so they wanted the best for their children. And so they piled these children into these Suburbans. They made the long journey across all these different borders. And these traffickers, they knew that when they got to the border, that the U.S. government was going to welcome unaccompanied minor children, okay, across our border, which to me is absolutely cuckoo, that you could have a 10, 11 year old kid that's not with a parent, aunt, uncle, guardian or whatever. And then another country, you know, is going to let a kid across an international border. They took these kids in and there was a very serious problem with lack of vetting. And so they had placed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of these unaccompanied children to these woke sponsors that had no relation to these children. And unfortunately, what they've uncovered now is that a lot of the children were provided a name and a number by the cartel or the trafficker and said, just say you're related to this person. And they pushed a lot of these kids out to other bad guys that were waiting for these kids. And then they were been put into the sex trade. They've been forced into these situations where they're forced into labor. They're all being, you know, trafficked across all these state lines. The articles from the New York Times have shown that, you know, that there's a few houses in Minnesota that got busted. They had 20 kids sleeping on two bedrooms floor like sardines. 15 passenger van would come and pick them up at 9 p.m. and they'd work till 3 a.m. These are 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 year old kids.
What were they doing?
In that article, that it was a pig slaughterhouse and they were cleaning all the floors and doing maintenance and janitorial work at a pig slaughterhouse. These are children. And so they got fined. The pig slaughterhouse said that it was their vendor and they had no idea.
It is impossible that the people who own the slaughterhouse did not know who was cleaning the slaughterhouse at midnight. And the security cameras would show all of that. Now they bust the slaughterhouse. Now they bust the people who have 22 kids sleeping in two rooms. What happens to the kids then?
There are some wonderful anti-trafficking agencies. Our film, City of Dreams, we have pledged to give 25% of our profits to A21. We want to make sure that the profits from this film go back to help the children. I watched this movie and I cried. A friend of mine, Sean Wolfington, who was one of the producers of another movie on the same topic, Sound of Freedom. And he said, look, John, this is a very important movie. Why don't you come and watch it? And I went and I watched it with him and I wept at the end of the movie. It touched me. And I don't really cry in movies. And it really, really touched me. And the movie had a deal with Roadside Attractions, a distributor, but it was only going to come out in about 75 or 80 theaters. And that's what happens to a lot of these independent films. And so I gave them $5 or $6 million to increase their marketing budget and to make sure that it could have a release that went throughout the whole country. And I felt strongly that the movie was that good and that the message was so important and that I'd learned from the director, Mohit Ramchandani, that he had based this on a true story about a sweatshop in L.A. that was busted. And he had explained to me that the trafficking over 6 or 7 years is up something like 400% and that all these kids are being kidnapped and it's just the big issue. And so it just made sense that I would decide to support this film and make sure that we could make sure that it was seen by as many people as possible.
Here's what you're going to do this month. Perfect Thanksgiving week event. You're going to go see City of Dreams. City of Dreams is the story about one kid who was trafficked from Mexico to a sweatshop in Los Angeles. Let's just think about that. Mexico to a sweatshop in Los Angeles, a prison for that kid. And it's part of a global crisis of child trafficking. It affects 12 million children. And at Thanksgiving, I want you to look at your kid at that table and think what would happen if that kid vanished, kidnapped, taken, put into a sweatshop, and possibly die from neglect. John Devaney, thank you very much for being on Sterling every damn night.